Upanasa. So, in the very next section of the text by Pinchen Rinpoche, he's taking an enormous step. He's moving from the limited domain, enormously important, but limited domain, of examining the self and the absence of an inherently existent self, which again is so crucial to our very existence, the way we navigate through life, through space. Starting there, kind of creating a beachhead, starting, you know, getting some certainty there, right in the center, right? And you recall in that analysis, there was at least one reference to the six elements, right? Earth, water, fire, air, space, and then consciousness. And that list, I'm quite sure, is meant to be inclusive. That is, everything within this phenomenal world in that fits within that matrix, within that context. And the previous analysis was to examine each of these six elements, earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness, and find that as one examines them, each one individually, and then they collectively, that you're just nowhere to be found. And if you're nowhere to be found amongst them, well, you can check very briefly to feel if you might be found outside of them. And if not, well, that pretty well does it in terms of there being a you that is findable under analysis. And what that means exactly, of course, is a you that was already there before you designated it, where the designation, the thought, the label, and so forth, is quite literally a mere afterthought, like a footnote on the presentation of the universe. Like, oh yeah, and we called it this, but it's a footnote. And then, of course, everything shifts all the way around. So we started there, and see that each of these six elements, again, individually, collectively, is empty of the identity of a person. And there's no such identity of a person found anywhere else. But what we didn't do in meditation, we won't do now either, but I would really encourage you to do it at your leisure, is to really linger in the awareness that you know, I'm quite sure you know conceptually, probably have no doubt about it, but experientially, it can really linger. And that is, not only are these phenomena of these six elements empty of I, but they're also empty of mine. And very often, you know, I playfully say that the cell phone, you know, its status as mine is purely nominal. Of course it is. We all know that. We all know that for other people's possessions. That their ownership of things is merely nominal. Right? But we can check for ourselves to see whether we ever take a sense of ownership as something being objective. This is my spouse. This is my home. This is my body. This is my country. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. My country. Not one of those inferior countries. The best one. That's mine. Right? That's what we learned. That's what we were told. America number one. Greatest country in the world. Well, some respects, yeah. I think it's true in some respects. It's the greatest at being in the United States anyway. So, but examining, you know, are these elements any less empty of mine than they are of I? And if we really see that, then that will change everything. To see that everything we identify as mine is just no more mine than the cell phone being mine. And that's pretty obvious, that it's just a cell phone. It's seeing the cell phone as a cell phone. It's seeing form as form, feelings as feelings. You remember that whole thing? So that's big, but we're moving on now. But that's worth lingering there. Whenever you see a sense of mind coming up, check for yourself. How are you apprehending the minus of that which you are perhaps quite accurately identifying as mine? I could say, Amy is my student. I think I can say that, at least for a while. And Shelty tell me otherwise. She's one of my students, right? What is that more? Is that anything more than this is my cell phone? Or this is my chair? Right? This is my chair. If you sit here, prepare to get kicked out. At least when I'm here. And that's my cottage over there. Wherever it is, over there. That's my cottage. My cottage. That's my student. That's my student. Yeah? To see how utterly light that is. How just ethereal. Less ethereal than a cirrus cloud. You know, because that actually has some things to it. So, but not to linger. But this is really worth doing. To linger there. And as you scan through, this would be fun to do right now, but we need to move on. And we will. But to scan through, you know, do that Cook's tour through the visual, the auditory, through the five physical senses, and then on into the mental domain. And to examine whether any of the appearances arising visually, whether the sense comes out mine. So as I gaze at Jeffrey's forehead, I see the color of his forehead, I see the patterns of his hair. Mine? Is mine? Not really. Sound? Is that my voice? Or is it just a voice? Is that my finger snap or just is that an anonymous finger snap? That's anonymous. But my voice, that's quite distinctive. Maybe that's my voice. Or maybe it's just a voice that I've grown very attached to. And smell and taste. And then we get to touch. We get feeling. Oh, that's the sensation. That's my sensation in my knee. How my is that? You know, those are my thoughts. One person was very disturbed, at least one person, but reporting to me, very disturbed by some of the thoughts that were coming up. A lot of mental afflictions coming up. In fact, I think two at least. were coming, oh, I'm so disturbed. I'm so disturbed, being assaulted by these thoughts. Why? My thoughts. If they're assaulting someone else, that'd be no problem. But they're assaulting me because they're my thoughts. Or my thoughts of desire, my thoughts of craving, and so forth and so on. So, why are some appearances sensory? Tactile, yes. The other ones, not so much. Mental appearances, thoughts, emotions. Are they just emotions or are they my emotions? And is the my more my than the ownership of a cell phone, which vanishes as soon as I say, Claudio, this belongs to you, you can have it now. So I said I wouldn't linger there, but it is an important area. We have to move on. We've done that. And at your leisure, look not only into the emptiness of I, but the emptiness of mine in any of the six elements. But then we move on. I said he's now making a major step to examine the six elements themselves and to see whether they exist by their own inherent nature or whether they're empty of themselves. Right? Are they too, the six elements, are they as empty? This seems really wild, outrageous, like borderline ridiculous. That the six elements, earth, water, fire, air, for example, that their ontological status, their way of being, the way they exist, is just as fluffy, as insubstantial, as nominal, as the ownership of this phone? That would be bizarre, wouldn't it? And that's exactly what they're saying. So as I said, I'm quite sure this is intended to be inclusive. And so the earth element, bear in mind this term is jungwa. And we translate it as element, has been long, I think it's okay. I just don't know a better one, but we should know the etymology of this is, I think it's in Sanskrit, Buddha, and in Buddha, and in Tibetan, Jungwa, and both have the connotation of becoming, emerging, coming forth. Not just the Western notion of element, like the periodic table of elements. Okay. Sodium, boom, chlorine, boom, iron, boom, copper, really like macho. That's what out there, that's what God sees. Right? That's what's really out there. From the God's eye perspective, inherently exists out there in the real world. That really brilliant chart, the They just found another element that fit in very nicely. So neat. Yeah? You see that? New one came up. Yeah? Fairly brief. Very, very short. It goes, great, and gone. But still it counts. It got to vote. I'm in. I'm a member of the club. So, but that's not the connotation in the Buddhist view, because the Buddhist view from the very beginning, from the time of the Buddha, was not to represent a pre-existing universe as it is out there independently of any description, independent of experience. Because after all, it's all about Four Noble Truths. And suffering does not exist independently of experience. And the source of suffering, karma, klesha, doesn't exist independent of experience. Doesn't even come up, it's silly. Freedom, nirvana, notion that there's some kind of nirvana all hanging out there like a fruit hanging from a tree, you have to pluck it, independent of experience, completely silly. And the notion of a path, independent of experience, makes no sense at all. And that's the structure of all of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths. And so it's all about loka, loka, the lived world, the world, the Germans have it in phenomenology, Husserl, Heidegger, Lebenswelt, the lived world, the world that we live in, the world we experience, the world of our experience, right? That's what Buddhism has always been about. So that's why some people, some philosophers I know, are very, very keen on the interface between Western phenomenology and Buddhism, Madhyamaka in particular. Okay, without lingering too long here, let's keep on moving on. These were emergences, but they're emergences relative to experience, because any entity that is irrelevant to all experience has no bearing on the Four Noble Truths. Right? Have no bearing, because the Four Noble Truths are all about experience. So if there's something independent of all experience, then who cares? You know. And so these are all emergences. Well, when speaking of, just for starters, the four elements, earth, water, fire, air, what these are referring to, of course, is anything out there. Look around. Those craggy peaks on the horizon, these soft, gently rolling green fields and hills and so forth. That which provides them with their solidity, just like the Higgs boson provides all particles with their mass, right? It provides them all with their mass. Well, that which provides the stability of the hill, of the hills, of the trees, of metal, of your kneecaps, and so forth, that's earth element. And wherever there's fluidity, whether it's moisture, whether it's water, whether it's wine, whether it's oil and so forth, any type of moisture, that which provides us with this moistureness is the water element. The whole gradient from cold to heat, that which provides the warmth of the sun, of the soil, and so forth and so on, that's the heat element. Stronger in some areas, colder on the others. Right? And then wherever there's lightness and motility, wherever there's motion, including vibration, the wind, growth, movement and so forth, that which enables the growth, the movement and so forth, air element. So it has a different connotation, doesn't it, than a periodic table of, you know, core, hardcore little nitty-gritty elements. Very Newtonian. Brilliant and extremely useful and very, very Newtonian. And then we have the domain in which all of the constituents of the physical world, earth, water, fire, air, take place. And bear in mind, this goes from elementary particles all the way up to galactic clusters. It's said they're all composed out of earth, water, fire, air, in this Lebenswelt, in this world of experience. So it's not in competition with the periodic table, because that's not a world of experience. That's purportedly describing what's out there independent of our experience, that we are representing with our definitions of the various elements and so on. So that which in which all of these events are enabled to take place, of course, is the space element. The space element. So we know a lot about space. So much is written about it. And we experience it. And then finally, consciousness. And I would say here, in this context, consciousness, if this is indeed an inclusive set of the six types of emergences, then consciousness. This term consciousness refers not only just to the flow of awareness, but all configurations of consciousness. So thoughts and images and dreams and emotions, desires, memories, fantasies, the space of the, well, and all of these activities of the mind, all these formations of consciousness, they would be included there. And if we understand consciousness in that way, and not just the flow of awareness, then Maybe we're done. Maybe that's inclusive. And then the question comes, and that's where we're going right now, is all right, these six elements, this is not a dualistic vision of reality. By my many friends who are scientific materialists, one is a very, very good friend of mine, very, very fine scientist, and whenever he refers to my worldview, he said, you're a dualist. But he's a materialist, he's a monist. Everything really boils down to matter and its emergent property. That's what he was taught. Because his training in neuroscience was entirely based on 19th century physics. And so when I sent him a paper, and this is a very intelligent man, but when I sent him some material on quantum cosmology, he just basically rolled his eyes and said, I don't have a clue what this is about. I don't know. I don't have training in physics. He had enough to be an outstanding brain scientist. And you will have no idea who I'm... If you think it's Richie Davidson, it's not. So you're not going to guess who I'm referring to. But he just couldn't relate to it at all. Because it played no part... 20th century physics played no part in his whole training. He's a senior scientist now, world reputation. And he looked at this and said, I can't make heads or tails of that. I don't even know how to start, you know. So how do these exist? So he refers to me in a very friendly way. We've had friendly debates and discussions and so forth. I mean, good friends. But he regards me as a dualist because I think of the mind as something other than matter, an emergent property of matter. And I always counter. I keep on saying it over and over again. It doesn't really seem to sink in. I'm not a dualist. I'm a pluralist. Because space is not composed of matter. He believes in space, I believe in space, so he believes in matter and space. He's already a dualist. Even if consciousness is just an emergent property of matter, he believes in space, so he's a dualist. But he's not a dualist. We also believe in time. Time is not composed of matter. So he's a trilogist. And then I believe in consciousness too. I'm a quadrupleist. Except for I believe in all six domains. I'm a sex addict. I don't know what the word is. It just came to mind. So how do they exist? Well, that's where we're going right now. That was much longer a prelude than I thought. But it's important. We're now going large. We could just go around thinking, well, individuals are empty of an inherent nature inside, and we exist in interdependence in this real physical world out there, which scientists are doing a magnificent job of representing with their myriad branches of science. Right? And now he's about to pull the rug out from all of reality and ask, okay, he's not questioning whether the six elements exist. Of course they do. Is there solid stuff out there? Is there hot stuff out there? Fluid? Things in motion? Of course there is. Is there space out there? Of course there is. Of course. Not in question. Any more than I'm here and David's there. Yeah. Let's get on to something interesting. How? In what fashion? And do these manifestations, these configurations of earth, water, fire, and of course combinations, mud, combination of earth element and water element, and so on. Thrown mud. Earth, water, and motility. Heat it up a little bit, hot thrown mud. Have all four elements all at once. You know? It appears to be really out there, right? Do you grasp it out there? So let's find out. Okay? But we're going to go right back into the lab, and the lab is awareness resting in its own nature. And then branch out from there. Please find a comfortable position. We'll jump in. Scientists seek objectivity, we seek balance, which provides a possibility for objectivity. Observing without bias, without disfiguring, coloring, tainting, warping that which we're seeking to attend to and understand. With this motivation, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. As always, this settling process culminates in your awareness coming to rest in its own nature. Still, clear, cognizant. Self-illuminating, self-knowing. Our starting point of knowing, this we would know, this we do know, I suggest, more indubitably than anything else we know. The knowing of knowing. So let's start as we explore the nature of reality from a point of certainty. Here I stand. Hear my awareness rest in its own nature, knowing itself. Then let your eyes be open. Let the light of your awareness flood the visual domain. Full awareness, single-pointed samadhi on the visual domain. In which these myriad colors and shapes emerge, shift, transform. Disappear. Intangible, immaterial, these visual forms. Keeping your eyes open, direct your attention now, your mental awareness, to the domain of sound. In the heard, let it be just the heard. Very temporarily, to the best of your ability, mute your tendency of conceptual designation, labeling, conceiving, associating. And rest in perception, perceiving sounds. very briefly, can you detect any smells? Any tastes? Also intangible, immaterial. Appearances to awareness. Still with the eyes open, direct your mental awareness single pointedly to the domain of the physical, where you have the insider's perspective, viewing a physical entity from the inside out. Observe this tactile field, the space of the body, and the manifestations, the emergences of earth, water, fire, air, within the space of the body. These appearances too, these somatic appearances are also intangible, immaterial, not composed of atoms or energy. They have no mass. They're not even located in physical space. None of these appearances are located in physical space. Briefly, now direct your attention single-pointedly to the space of the mind and whatever configurations of consciousness, thoughts, images, memories, and so on, desires and emotions, whatever arises as configurations of consciousness within this space. Observe closely, identify their nature. These two are also, of course, immaterial, intangible, having no objective existence in and of themselves, consisting only of appearances to awareness. Now thus far we've muted our very habitual tendency to conceptually designate, to conceptually make sense of, to objectify and subjectify our world into a world populated with objects and subjects. Now remove the mute. Allow the conceptual mind off the leash. Let conceptual designations flow unimpededly. There's the sound of a bird. There's the feel of the cushion. There's someone moving his hand. So having clearly noted this matrix of appearances by way of six doors of perception, observe your own conceptual mind designating objects. Designating people, including yourself, but designating all manner of objects in the surrounding environment. Whenever you think of anyone, anything, any place, observe the mind that is designating the objects that come to mind. Observe how it designates, how your conceptual mind apprehends the objects that it conceives. The mode of appearances is fairly clear if we've examined them closely. The manner in which we conceptually designate, label, identify objects and subjects should be evident. You can watch yourself do it or watch your mind do it. But then when you identify an object that has been designated by your mind, then it's time to ask, not whether that object exists, let's assume it does. How does it exist? The designated object. What is its basis of designation? Or bases? Maybe it has more than one. And is the basis of designation of any object that comes to mind identical with the object you designate upon that basis? A bird is physical, composed of atoms. Its body is composed of atoms. It's located within physical space. There's no question about that. True. And likewise for the myriad objects in the surrounding environment, composed of matter, configurations of mass energy located in physical space. We'll accept that. So we're not questioning whether such objects exist. We're simply asking how. if there's a sequence here, and there doesn't need to be, but methodologically, if we choose to have a sequence, attend first to the mode of appearances in these six domains. How do they appear? In the scene, let there be just the scene, in that mode. And with the activation of the conceptual mind, the mind that designates, the mind that objectifies, observe how your mind, conceptual mind, designates and identifies objects, knows objects, apprehends objects by way of conceptual designation. Designated objects upon a basis of designation. Observe how that occurs. You're doing it. You should be in plain sight. And once you've identified the manner in which your mind designates objects, then examine, finally, in what manner does that designated object exist? Was it already there prior to and independent of the conceptual designation? If so, can you identify it? Can you see it prior to conceptually designating it? And that object, that physical object, such as a bird, or the bird's body, more specifically, does it exist within the six domains of your experience, those six modes of appearances? Among any one of them individually? Among one or more collectively? Or does that physical entity exist independently of all modes of appearance? If so, what does it look like? How do you identify it? How do you know it? If those five elements of earth, water, fire, air, and space, physical space, if they're really out there, objectively, existing from their own side, prior to and independent of all appearances to your mind, to anyone's mind, prior to and independent of any conceptual designation, how do you apprehend them? And when you do, what comes to mind? And if there arises an insight into the sheer emptiness of objective inherent existence, the sheer absence of any such inherent existence. Then rest for a little while, single-pointedly, in meditative equipoise, sustaining that awareness of the sheer emptiness of objective inherent existence. Let it seep in. So we've already asked how do we exist, each of us individually, covered that, been there, done that. And now we just move on to how does everything else exist? Other people, environment, physical universe, how does everything else exist? I think it's very important, as we're venturing into this material, which is so central to the whole Mahayana tradition and Dzogchen and Mahamudra, that we read it with the advantage of reading it from the 21st century and not from the 19th century. Because from the 19th century, this just doesn't fly. It just doesn't fly at all. If 19th century physics is correct, all of this is hogwash. Just religious mumbo jumbo. And it's important to recognize there are enormous, extremely powerful vested interests within academia, within the scientific community, within business and the media. And business, for example, the pharmaceutical industry, enormous vested interest to maintain the status quo of metaphysical realism, because it seems like the whole credibility of science depends on that. If scientists are not describing what's really out there, what the hell are they doing? Making up worlds? Eeny, meeny, miny, mo? You know, they sound like a bunch of California hippies. No, it's my reality, dude. Oh, no, it's my reality. You know, they sound like a joke. You know? And that's the first thought. If Stephen Hawking and Thomas Hertog are right, then, well, if they can make up their stories, then why should they have the franchise? Why only scientists? Why can't the poets, the philosophers, the artists, the gardeners, why can't they make up their own reality? If there's no reality out there, if there's no history out there of what really took place, how about religious fundamentalists? Why not just say, hey, you know, if the creationists think there is six-day creation, that's true for them. It sounds like it's a grab bag, which means there's no truth at all. It's just whatever you like, as you like it. So the forces to preserve the status quo are monumental, enormously strong. There's so much money, so much prestige, and power embedded in maintaining metaphysical realism, and of course within that context, scientific materialism. I read the press a lot, and I virtually never see it challenged. New York Times, I can't remember the last time New York Times. I read it every day. I can't remember the time that they challenged that. They'll cite a person who says, you know, that consciousness doesn't exist. They're happy to cite that. But the notion that consciousness might actually play a pretty important role in reality never comes up. And that's for all the other major media that I look at on a regular basis. They've bought in, and they are preserving that. Just as they made Donald Trump a celebrity. If he didn't have the support of the media, he'd be an unknown, quirky, weirdo New York businessman who inherited $200 million and had a lot of fun with it. So what? So enormous vested interest there, you know. And so there's brilliant science that isn't being covered. And I'm about to read you some of it. Just so that when we launch back into the 17th century text, we're launching back from the 21st century and not from the fictions of the 19th century. Because that, every decent scientist, every knowledgeable physicist knows that 19th century physics was completely, in terms of its underlying metaphysical assumptions, disemboweled. Absolute space, time, matter, energy, and the notion that their universe consists of these little tiny nuggets of independently existing electrons and so forth, it's blown to smithereens. I think we'll never get it back, right? That doesn't come up much in the popular media. And even at the Higgs boson, not the Large Hadron Super Collider, where they have about 3,000 employees, I understand. I've read about this, and I understand that they're among the physicists there. They have actually two different factions. And it's not like they're fighting or anything, but just two different kinds of training. And some are very well versed in quantum mechanics. And the whole notion that particles, including the Higgs boson, do not exist prior to an independent of measurement. They're there. I mean, they're not censored. And then there are others who are metaphysical realists and say, we've discovered the Higgs boson, which that real particle out there which imbues all other particles of mass. Two groups, very different ontological perspectives, living under the same roof. I think it's very cool. Because no one should be able to silence another group. Somebody's wrong, so we should just, in a friendly conversation, find out what. So let's turn now to, just briefly, let's turn back to André Linde. André Linde, brilliant. He's very, very distinguished. It's not just my opinion. It's an objective fact. Very distinguished astrophysicist at Stanford University, full professor there. He's Russian from origin, but has been doing research and teaching, writing in the United States for years. And he addresses here, and I'm going to quote him verbatim, and I'll show you exactly. It's a paper called Inflation, Quantum Cosmology, and the Anthropic Principle by André Linde. And he's addressing a topic I've been intrigued by for some time now called the problem of frozen time. And that is when you apply the principles of quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger wave equation mathematically, you apply that to the entire universe and view the whole universe as a quantum system, rather than thinking of quantum system as little places that you have to protect from the surrounding environment of classical physics, and then they disappear when you stop creating and nurturing them, just viewing the whole shebang, the whole universe as a quantum system. Well, they've done that. A man named Bryce DeWitt and then his mentor John Wheeler did the mathematics for it, superb mathematics. And one of the odd things they found about the mathematics was when you view the whole universe as a quantum system, the element of time falls out. It disappears from the equations. And if time falls out, then the universe you're describing with that equation is static. The universe is static. Okay. Nothing changes. Well, that's not how things look at all. But that's where the equation says. The time dropped out. There's no time. So it's called frozen time. That if we take if that's all there is to the universe, then the universe should be and appear to be absolutely frozen. No time, everything static. Right? It's called the problem of frozen time. Here in André Linde's own words, he responds to that problem from the perspective of quantum mechanics, quantum cosmology. The resolution of this paradox, how could it be that the equation would say that the universe is frozen when obviously it's not? The resolution of this paradox suggested by Bryce DeWitt is rather instructive. I love the muted, rather instructive. He sounds British. It's rather instructive, but he's Russian. The notion of evolution is not applicable to the universe as a whole, in light of this frozen time business, the notion that transformation, evolution of the universe is not applicable to the universe as a whole, since there is no external observer with respect to the universe. And there is no external clock that does not belong to the universe. So there's no, he's suggesting, hey, we have no evidence for, we cannot even scientifically wrap our minds around the notion of there being some divine being who is the timekeeper, the great clockmaker, which was the medieval notion of God, one part of it. Okay, we can't deal with that scientifically, so let's not rely upon God to set the universe in motion. Otherwise, it's not science anymore. Then we just call ourselves theologians. Right, but we're trying to be scientists here. So we're not going to give God that status of enabling the universe to evolve, because that's just not physics anymore. It's straight theology. But also there's no external clock that does not belong to the universe. So if the universe is changing, it has to change relative to some clock, some timepiece, but there's no external clock out there either. Right? However, we do not actually ask why the universe as a whole is evolving. We don't ask that. We're just trying to understand our own experimental data. So this is a radically empirical question. Thus, a more precisely formulated question is, why do we see the universe evolving in time in a given way? Okay, so, not whether it does, how it does, why it does. That's a good question. So then we know we're keeping real here. Because it's very clear the universe appears to be changing, evolving. In order to answer this question, one should first divide the universe into two main pieces. First, an observer with his clock and other measuring devices. And two, the rest of the universe. Then it can be shown that the wave function of the rest of the universe, this is the Schrödinger wave function, the fundamental equation for all of quantum mechanics, when applied to the universe, then it can be shown that the wave function of the rest of the universe does depend on the state of the clock of the observer, that is to say, on his time, the time of an observer. Now, relative to the time of the observer, you can say the universe is evolving relative to that cognitive frame of reference. Because it's a cognitive frame of reference, not a spatial. We're not asking how fast that observer is traveling. It's irrelevant. That's not the question. But somehow we have to introduce time, and someone has to be aware of the time. Okay? So we now have two pieces. The observer with his clock and other measuring devices, and of course you make a measurement, and then the superposition state collapses and you have an actuality, right? And it happens at a certain point in time, right? Ordinary classic quantum mechanics. And then we have the rest of the universe. So now we have subject and object. But the subject is actually necessary for the object to be able to evolve. Then it can be shown, So this time dependence, in some sense is objective, again in quotation marks or inverted commas, it's objective. The results obtained by different macroscopic observers, like us, living in the same quantum state of the universe, here we are in this collective reality, and using sufficiently good macroscopic measuring apparatus, agree with each other. In other words, there's intersubjective validation among multiple observers. But the observers are necessary on the subjective side with our clocks, our sense of time, and our measuring devices. And relative to that, we have the universe, and now, of course, the two are mutually interdependent. Because if you have no universe, you don't have any observers, at least not with clocks and measuring devices. But if you don't have observers with clocks and measuring devices, you don't have a universe that changes. And that's the empirical evidence, and that's the mathematical formulation as well. So this is science. It's not mumbo-jumbo. And then he adds, thus we see that without introducing an observer, we have a dead universe which does not evolve in time. This example demonstrates an unusually important role played by the concept of an observer in quantum cosmology. John Wheeler underscored the complexity of the situation, replacing the word observer by the word participant, and introducing such terms as a self-observing universe. Don't read that in the New York Times every day, or in Scientific American or any of the major journals. It's there. And again, this is This is John Wheeler, this is Anton Zeininger, it's Stephen Hawking, it's Andre Lint, it's Paul Davies. They're not flaky fringe physicists out there, you know, smoking dope and just writing mumbo jumbo. It doesn't get any better than these people, but it's not appearing. It's not common knowledge, even among physicists, let alone other scientists, let alone the general public. But this makes the whole notion of consciousness emerging from the brain as a little side product just completely a joke. Like, you got to be kidding. You couldn't have been more wrong. Imagine how you could be more wrong than that, if this is true, that consciousness is just a little function of accidental byproduct of sufficiently complex activities of neurons. It's just like a belly laugh. Like, boy, if it said Captain Kangaroo created the universe, I guess that would be sillier. Not sure. So we'll pause there. But now we've planted ourselves in the 21st century, which is a good place to be. I mean, that's where we are. So from that perspective, let's go back to the 17th century text. Okay? So, we've just finished the presentation of the lack of self, of inherent identity of oneself. And then, to read the last line that I read earlier, for the purpose of demonstrating the way to meditate on the lack of self in other persons. So we start from the center of the mandala, but of course, as for oneself, then likewise for others. We apply the same analysis to other sentient beings, people, and so on. And phenomena. To demonstrate the way to meditate on the lack of self or identity in other persons and phenomena at large, everything else. The root text explains, in the same way that the individual was analyzed, examined, in terms of how we appear, each of us, how we appear to ourselves, right? Whether in the mirror, whether looking at our bodies, whether watching our minds, how do we appear? How do we designate ourselves? So here's a sequence again that, if we're going to make a sequence, as good as any. How do we appear? That's straightforward. I'm watching, right? And then I'm not just watching, though. This mind is active and it conceives. It can be conceiving. So how do I conceive of myself? How do I think of myself? What's my sense of myself as an individual? How does that occur? And then once I've conceived of myself, I am this, I am that, without questioning whether I exist or I am this or that. We can make mistakes, but a lot of our self appraisals are valid. You know, I'm an American, I'm this, I'm that. Sure, okay. How is that the case? Right? So there's the sequence. If you want a sequence, look at the obvious, what's in your face, appearances. How do you designate yourself on the basis of those appearances? And now that you've designated yourself in multiple ways, how is it that you exist? Okay? And now in the same way, we go to the root text, in the same way that we did that, in the same way the individual elements are not real because they are composites. The individual elements refers to the six elements that we just examined. They're not real. Well, of course, here real means they're not inherently existent. Any more than you as an individual, as self of a person, any more than you're real, that is to say, existing by your own inherent nature, in the same that you are not real, neither is anything else. None of the four physical elements, not space or consciousness. And why? But it's interesting reasoning and not at all obvious. Why are they not real? Why are they not inherently exist? Why are they not truly exist? Because they are composites. Because they're composites. That, for a brilliant mind, is sufficient. Just a brilliant mind that was very finely tuned, very ripe, very sharp faculties would look at that and say, yep, done, we're done. We're done here. That's got to be true. And to a metaphysical realist, including very smart ones, and there are many, many who are very smart, they say, that just doesn't follow at all. They would say, you know, because things are composite, they are arising independent upon causes and conditions. They're there. What do you mean they're not real? I mean, they were created by the process of evolution, the Big Bang, inflationary period, formation of galaxies, planets, solar systems. They emerge, they develop. I mean, don't tell me they're not real. That was all to show they are real. And he's saying, no, he turned it right on his head. Because they're composites, therefore they're not inherently existent. because they're composites. I'm running an experiment here, you have to watch. On my lap, apart from my shamdap, my lower robe, on my lap, there's an eyeglass carrier, there's a computer, and a little computer we call a smartphone. They're all on my lap. Three things. One, two, three. I'm going to coin a term that I'm going to designate on the basis of the combination. It might be very useful for some people. It's conceivable that there's a single entity. It's called the collection. It's called the laptopo smartofono eyeglass carrier. It's a special combination, but very useful. This combination, this collection, is a single entity. It's a collection that has three parts. Like, I have two parts. I have body and mind. This touch slightly more complex. This collection, this entity, this one entity, this singular entity on my lap, has three elements to it, right? And it's got a laptop. That's one component of it. And it's got eyeglass care. That's another component of it. And then there's the smartphone component of it. It's one thing, but it has three parts. Any problem there? This house, this building here, it has four walls, it has posts, it has a ceiling, and it's one entity. We're living in one house, not a multiple house, not a bunch of houses. And the one house has many components, right? And they're all created, they're composite. So the house is a composite of many parts. And I'm saying, here's another component, and it's one house, and we're all in it. We all agree on that, it's true. And I'm going to just say that in the world I'm living in, suddenly for a little while anyway, it's going to be useful to me to speak of a... I think Fribble was taken, right? Smorge. A smorge. A smorge is a unique configuration of laptop, cell phone, and an eyeglass carrier that sometimes appear on the lap, which is very useful. Because that's all we need. Is it useful or not? Is it useful to speak of houses? Yeah, it's useful. This is very useful because I'm a speaker here and I need my eyeglass, which means I carry, and I need my laptop, otherwise I can't give the talk. And the smartphone, well, it's right there. I'm a Dharma teacher. And so this is my assemblage of my accoutrements, my utensils as a Dharma teacher. And the complete set consists of three parts, and it's called a smorge. A smorge, yeah. So right now there's a smorge on my lap. There's no problem here, is there? It's not unusual. It's not weird. There's one entity here. It's a smorge. And you can see. Do you see the smorge? You see Elizabeth? See the smorge on my lap? Yeah? Free? Any problem? You can see the smorge, can't you? And you can see it has three parts. And now there's no longer a smorge on my lap because I just took the eyeglass carrier. It's this kind of like, it's a broken smorge. It's like, you know, like a wagon with only two wheels. It's kind of like broken, but I'm going to restore it. Oh, now the smorge is complete. Okay. The smorge is like every other composite in the universe. It doesn't matter how close they are. That is, whether it's a single entity, doesn't matter how close they are. I could have an enormous lap and they could be separated by, you know, a lot of space. It's just a big smorge and a great big lap. It doesn't matter how close they are, that's not the issue. It's just whether that configuration is there so that I can designate smorge. And there it is. I've got a smorge on my lap. I'm now a fully capable Dharma teacher. Replete with smorge. Give you the oral transmission on creating smorges. You need it in the 21st century. It's hard to be a Dharma teacher without the smorge. Never leave home without it. You know? This is funny. In case you hadn't noticed, it's funny. But it's completely normal. How many solar systems are there around our sun? Well, nobody in his right mind would say there's more than one. And how many planets are there in the solar system? Well, that depends on whether you still want to count Plato. Pluto. Plato's Pluto. It got demoted, but a dwarf planet, right? So it's like one of the seven dwarfs. It's a little one. But I think it still counts. I guess it still counts. Yeah? Dwarf. not just a rock. Well, what's the difference? Smorgh and solar system? None. It's called the Mariological Sun. It's a single entity, but do you find that entity among any of the individual components? And was it already there as the collection of the planets with the sun? Was it already there before you designated it? And the demarcation, does it include the asteroid belt? This is an asteroid belt, right? Isn't there an asteroid belt? Yeah. Pretty sure, yeah. Does the solar system include the asteroid belt? Where does the line draw? Where, and of course, the gravitational field from our solar system, with the sun, of course, providing most of it, that extends off and into infinite space, inversely, in inverse square law. So does the our solar system end at what point? Because the gravitational field of... Gravitational field is a property of our solar system, right? Correct? Gravity, it's a property of our solar system. But the gravitational field actually never becomes zero. It's an inverse square law. It just gets smaller and smaller. It goes out into infinite space. Billions of light years away, it's extremely small, but it's not zero. So I guess our solar system extends throughout all of space. Right? But nobody really thinks that. So who brought out the cookie cutter and said, this is where your solar system ends, Buster. This is our solar system on this side. Conceptual designation did that, not reality. And who said there was one solar system rather than just one big fiery ball and a bunch of stuff around it? Which is a whole bunch of stuff. So, smorgh, solar system, elementary particle, which has multiple attributes, galaxies, of course, all in the same ontological status. There's nothing really to laugh about among any of them. And none of them were already what they were before we designated them, and none of them, crucially, have drawn their own borders. A single electron. You say, oh, but, okay, that's finite space. I understand, I read within the last couple of years that a single electron, when I studied physics, I was told it has zero spatial dimension. And then I've heard more recently, no, it does have a tiny, tiny bit of spatial dimension. It occupies a tiny, tiny bit of space. Fine. But the gravitational field of an electron, that's not confined to that space. So where does the electron stop? Because its gravitational field is a property of the electron. And that extends out through infinite space as well. Right? So... composites, how do they exist? How does the smorgh exist? The smorgh came into existence, I think this is pretty obvious, when I designated smorgh. And then throughout, on the rest of the planet, wherever there's somebody sitting with a laptop, a cell phone, and an eyeglass carrier on their lap, we now know this is universally true. I mean, in Brazil and Uruguay and Iceland, smorgh is suddenly cropped up everywhere. They may not recognize, but that's their problem. Illiterate. What do those Iceland people know? They don't know a smorgh when they're looking at it. But I do. Because I designated it. I said, let there be. And it was. And it was throughout. It was last year, too. There were smorgh's last year. Right? I'm not the first person to have a laptop, cell phone, and eyeglass carry on my lap. This occurred last year. They had smorgh's on their lap. And even if I die this year, there will be smorgh's next year too, I'm sure. Somebody's going to have a laptop, the three, and they'll have a smorgh on their lap. And maybe the word will get out, if you help. Oxford English Dictionary, here we come. Smorgh is on its way. It just depends on how useful it is. But talk about it. Talk about it, you know. Smorgh, yeah. I have this really cool, got a new computer, my smorgh was upgraded fantastically. So that's what he's saying here. They're not real because they're composites. And a composite exists only because there's a conceptual designation of it, and it didn't already exist. That's what he's saying. So we're finished. But he'll give us more to work with than that. In accordance with that statement, there it is. And this really is the king of reasonings within Madhyamaka. Because phenomena are dependently related events, therefore they are empty of inherent nature. And if they're dependent in any of the three ways, they're empty of inherent nature. He's saying right here, composite is something that arose independent upon prior causing conditions and is a composite. an array of qualities, parts, components. That's enough. You're nailed, you're convicted, you're empty of inherent nature. Because you're a composite, because you arose independent upon causing conditions. Exactly when did you come into existence? When is it a sprout and when is it a seed? At what moment objectively, as the seed germinates, and then there's a sprout, objectively speaking, with no subjective input, no observer with a time clock and a measuring device, objectively, when did the sprout happen? When was the first moment of the sprout? The seed germinates, you put some water on it. Okay, it germinates. When is it no longer a seed, and when did the seed terminate, and when did the sprout originate? What was the moment of cessation? What was the moment of origination, objectively? Good luck. And on this note, we'll return very briefly to another brilliant physicist, outstanding physicist, Paul C.W. Davies. He's very, very highly respected. He's a major proponent of quantum cosmology. He's written about John Wheeler extensively, theoretical physicist of excellent repute. And I just have one brief quote from him. You ready for this one? You've not seen this one before. And I give the source. It's in an article that he wrote, an overview of the contributions of John Archibald Wheeler. I think it was on his 90th birthday. Here's what he says. Without a miracle, how can something come to exist that did not exist before? A miracle, objectively, in that real universe, separate from the observer with the clock and the measurement, if it wasn't there before, it would take a miracle for it to come into existence. So that's what a literal reading of the Genesis account says. A miracle worker created ex nihilo, out of nothing, something that wasn't there before. Okay, fine, then you have an answer. God did it. It's not a scientific answer, but it's certainly an answer. But then can you point to the God, and do you have a reputable source who saw it? Who witnessed it? Where's the empirical evidence? How did you measure it? How do you confirm it? This is an interesting theory. How do you repudiate it? How do you test it? If all you've got is a book, well, there are a lot of books. And a lot of them claim to be authoritative. So what are we supposed to do with that? It's not science anyway. So he says, without a miracle, how can something come to exist that did not exist before? How, if there wasn't a smorge here already, how could, and it wasn't there, how could a smorge come into existence if it wasn't before? And there is an answer. No miracle. Just speak it into existence. Conceptually designate it. And that will do. And the basis of designation is laptop, cell phone, eyeglass carrier. Okay. Back to the 17th century. But it doesn't seem like we're really moving through time much, does it? So in accordance with that statement, when you search, you do not find even the minutest particle of equipoise, this meditative equipoise. He's still coming. This is very much a contemplative approach. Enriched with really sharp intelligence. So it's not just shamatha. Resting in shamatha, really fine shamatha, and then enriched with incisive questions. When you search, again from the context of meditative equipoise, you do not find even the minutest particle of some reality, some entity called meditative equipoise. That's a noun, right? It's a noun. It's an entity, something that exists, which means it's designated on the basis of some basis of designation. The state of meditative equipoise, you don't find even the minutest particle of such. You do not find even the minutest particle of equipoise, the one who rests in equipoise, and so on. The agent, the meditator, you don't find the minutest particle of some self-existent phenomenon called meditative equipoise, or one who's resting in that state, and so forth, or anything else. You don't find the minutest particle. A not finding, right? At that time, undistracted and single-pointed, maintain the space-like equipoise. Having realized the emptiness of even a trace, when speaking of my nudist particle, he's speaking a little bit symbolically here. When you don't find even a trace of anything that exists by its own inherent nature prior to an independent of conceptual designation, either in this field, which we call meditative equipoise, or the one who's resting in meditative equipoise, the agent, the subject, the observer, if you don't find even the trace, a whisker, of an actual inherent nature, you see the not finding of that, then undistracted, single-pointed, come right back to your shamatha and fuse your shamatha with your vipassana and rest in this space-like meditative equipoise. So as we'll see, it's hard to go quickly through this text. It's really dense, and I think my perspective is it's quite brilliant. My nudist particle, well, no, probably nobody really thought, unless they're really, really out there materialist, would think that when you're resting in meditative equipoise, that state itself is composed of elementary particles. I don't know anybody actually believes that. They might very well think that it's an emergent property of neurons. Okay, I understand. There's no evidence for it. A lot of people believe that. Hence, you must understand the underlying neural mechanisms of meditative equipoise. But does anybody really think that meditative equipoise is composed of particles? Or that the one who rests, the meditator, well, I guess so. If they think the meditator is a body, then the body is composed of particles. But there's no evidence for that either, just supposition. But I would suggest here, I was just reflecting on this, or just the thoughts came to mind in meditation prior to coming here, that when we speak of the four elements, for example, the various configurations, just as in modern physics, we speak of configurations of matter-energy. And everything in the physical universe is space, time, and then configurations of mass energy. Well, from this loka perspective, that is viewing the lived world, the Lebenswelt, then we have these six elements. We have the four elements comprising the physical universe. And they are composed of particles in the Buddhist view. The Abhidhamma particle theory is wildly different from that of, you know, our periodic table. Doesn't mean it's very, very different, because it's attempting to do something different. The methodology and what they're seeking to describe is different. Right? But the elements of the particles, that is the components of these physical entities like trees and mountains and so forth, they are created of particles which are to be, that have spatial extension, the res extensa of Descartes. They take up a certain region of space. The tree has a mass, it's this volume within physical space. So it has that. And then, of course, the tree wasn't there 1,000 years ago, but won't be there 1,000 years from now, the one I'm pointing to right now. And so I've seen this in relativity theory. You have a graph where you have the three spatial dimensions and you have a fourth vector, and that's time. So you can describe the space in terms of its layout in three-dimensional space. And then you can add a fourth element on this graph, on this three-dimensional graph, or four-dimensional graph, and that is how long was it? When did it start, and how long did it last? Okay, space-time. So the tree exists in space-time, right? It occupies that region of space and this region of time, right? So that's good. That's very useful. And then relativity theories work that extensively, both special and general relativity. When it comes, though, to states of consciousness, like thoughts, configurations of consciousness, thoughts, emotions, mental images, memories, fantasies, dreams, and so forth. Well, they do exist in time. How long did your dream last? And then you say it lasted, well, I had a sense it lasted an hour, 5 minutes, whatever. So it's extended in time. But how big was your dream? How much of physical space did it occupy? That just doesn't make any categorical error. That doesn't make any sense. Or my hope that something will happen. It's a categorical error. Just like, there's just no way to answer it. That's not a meaningful question, because there's no possible way to answer that question meaningfully except to say, stop asking that question. Because it doesn't mean anything. So mental events, configurations of consciousness, do occupy a time vector. They last for a certain amount of time. Right, but not a space vector. Right? Whereas physical objects occupy both. even this new element that was found for the periodic table. It's extremely brief, but brief still for a finite time and occupies a certain region of space. So that's different. And so when we speak of particle, well, we can say, okay, it's meant literally for those physical phenomena created of earth, water, fire, air. Good. I don't know anybody really that thinks that a thought is the thought itself, the thought of my mother, is actually composed of particles. I don't know anybody who thinks that. It's such an obvious categorical error. I don't think so. So now let's not even go there because nobody thinks it anyway. So, he's not talking about silly stuff here. So let's assume he's a very intelligent man and he's not saying something that everybody knows is silly. So in this context, particle would not be a particle of matter for equipoise and the person dwelling in equipoise. It'd be a particle of time. Kshana, I think it's called in Sanskrit. Or kajigma, a moment, a particle of time, a quanta of time, a pulse of time. Right? A moment. So do you find in a state of meditative equipoise that it's composed of particles of time, pulses of time that exist by their own inherent nature? He's going to get to that very shortly. But that one's a meaningful question. Right? We'll find very commonly in Mahamudra and Dzogchen that the approach, which is extremely obvious in Dzogchen Lingpa's writings, that he asks about the primacy, which one, body, speech, and mind? Bing, got the right answer, it's mind. Mind is the all-creating sovereign. Mind creates samsara and nirvana. Mind is creator of all. Mind is the root of all. Good. It looks like we're chittamatrans up to our eyeballs. Chittamatra, mind only. There's nothing out there except for mind and appearances to mind. That's it. So, whoa, okay. I think the ship of scientific materialism just sunk with all hands on board. I mean, it's like, whoa, did you get that one wrong? Because what we're saying from this chittamatra perspective is matter doesn't even exist. That which you thought everything was derivative of doesn't exist at all. It's nothing more. All we have is appearances to the mind, and they're not material. The appearances of solidity, of moisture, of fluidity, and so forth, they're not material. And so you materialists believe in matter like theists believe in God. You can't imagine the universe without it, and yet you can't see it. Nobody's ever seen it. This God that exists as external creator. What a laugh. And you say, we're the believers. You people base the whole of reality in something you can't see and nobody's ever seen. Matter as it exists independently of objective space. What a joke. So what's he going to do with this? So commentary. For some people, that may be sufficient. You don't find even an inherently existent pulse, a temporal particle of meditative equipoise or the person who's abiding in over time. You don't find even a pulse that's inherently existent. I was saying the strategy is mind is primary, mind is all-creating sovereign. And then what? And then what? What's the next stage? Gotcha. Investigate the investigate the nature of the existence of mind. So you put all of reality, on the shoulders of the mind. The mind now is supporting all of reality. And then you see the mind is empty. It's brilliant. It's really quite brilliant. So snuff out that sneeze. Just to give somebody come back. You torpedo scientific materialism because that's just detritus. It's just garbage. So throw that one out and we're left with something that's kind of like monumental, mind only, and then torpedo that. And if you torpedo it too much, what he called over-pervasive, remember that? Then you wind up with nihilism. You've just blown away all of reality because you put all your cookies in one jar, the mind jar, and then you blew up that jar. You wind up with nihilism or the California hippie dude that says, hey, reality is whatever you think. And that's just another form of nihilism, because that means the word reality doesn't mean anything. It's whatever you think. And so there's a middle way there. That's why they teach, it says, teach emptiness with caution. People will very, very easily misunderstand it one way or another, either by negating too little and still having their security blanket of a real objective world, probably made of matter, or objecting or negating too much, in which they're completely at a loss with nothing. They are nobody in a world that doesn't exist. So there's a middle way there. So he, in his commentary, then continues, "Also, when all phenomena of samsara and nirvana, all ordinary and arya beings, the outer and inner earth element," the inner is the earth element within your body, the outer is outside of your body, "and likewise the water, fire, air, space, and consciousness elements. When all the phenomena of samsara and nirvana, including all the above, have been ascertained as individual or collective appearances in your mind." That's it. All of reality consists of individual or collective appearances in your mind. "Then analyze the aforementioned individual's way of appearing and way of being grasped." Okay? So everything consists only of appearances to your mind, in your mind. Okay, now examine what is the individual's way of appearing and way of being grasped, the individual or the individual's mind. Now take that nuke with which you've just eliminated a whole objectively real physical universe out there for lack of evidence, because nobody had ever seen it, and is unknowable even if it did exist, is unknowable in principle, therefore do not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle. You have only appearances to the mind. And so everything hinges on mind, then probe into the individual's way of appearing, the individual's way of being grasped. And that means you have to go right in the nature of mind and establish yourself in equipoise, seeing the very emptiness of equipoise and the one who rests in equipoise. "When you do not find even the minutest particle that is truly exist," that not finding is said to be the supreme finding, and not seeing to be the highest seeing. And of course, crucially important, I've said this before, I'll say it again, it's not that you just couldn't find it. I gotta know where I left my keys. It's you find that is not to be found. You do find its absence. So by seeing the ultimate nature of the mind, this is the cittata, or the dhammata of the mind. It's the emptiness of the mind. So by seeing the ultimate nature of the mind, its emptiness of inherent nature, that is identifying the mind. So when they speak of, in Dzogchen literature, Mahamudra literature, when they say identifying the mind, searching for the mind, identifying the mind, they're not talking about its relative status. That's easy. I just saw a thought, just like seeing Beata's face, I've seen Beata. Oh, finished. I just saw a thought, I saw my mind. Finished. No, wait a minute, that was just nominal. The mind, did you really find it? That mind that exists prior to and independent of conceptual designation. So by seeing the ultimate nature of the mind, the very emptiness of inherent nature of the mind, that is identifying the mind. So you should maintain a space-like equipoise, unwavering and single-pointed, directly on the mere absence of true existence, which is ultimate reality. That's shunyata. Alternatively, and this one's so interesting, this one line here, has enormous implications for Vajrayana and Dzogchen in particular. Alternatively, the subtle basis for imputing a self, the subtle basis of designation for yourself, okay? The subtle basis, the coarse basis, you have a whole bunch of them, right? Your body, your face, your intelligence, your memory, your personal history, your gender, your ethnicity, we have just slews of viable, meaningful bases of designation on the coarse level. No problem. I'm tall, I'm this, I'm that. But then, if we go to a deeper level, and we identify in a subtle basis of imputing self, the subtle basis for imputing a self is said to be the very subtle energy mind, pranacitta, the very subtle energy mind. And the practical instructions affirm one identifies the mind in order to determine the nature of existence of the mind. So I changed that around a good bit. So we could just pair subtle to subtle, which would be, I like precision. The subtle basis for imputing a self is said to be the subtle energy mind. That would be a good match, good parity, right? And what continues on from lifetime to lifetime? Subtle energy mind. Right? It's not just the substrate consciousness or bhavanga or subtle continued mental consciousness. Because wherever consciousness goes, there goes together with it prana. They're always intertwined with each other, or the same nature, a continuum. So we have coarse energy mind. And the coarse energies are what all of you are experiencing in your bodies whenever you meditate or whenever you pay attention. And coarse mind is what you watch when you're settling the mind in this natural state. And then you dissolve, from your perspective, you dissolve your mind, your coarse mind, into subtle mind. And physiologically, your coarse energies are going into the heart chakra, right where they go when you go deep asleep. So the coarse energies are dissolving into subtle energy. You can rest there in meditative equation shamatha. And bear in mind, you don't have duct tape over your mouth when you're resting in shamatha. You can talk, you can think if you like. Coarse examination, subtle analysis, you can think. And so if you wish to, as you're resting in shamatha, then you can designate yourself. I'm resting in shamatha. You can say that. You don't have a gag rule. I'm resting in shamatha. I've achieved shamatha. I've achieved shamatha. I'm resting in shamatha. I'm resting in meditative equipoise. Valid, good. Congratulations. Right? What's the basis of designation? Subtle energy mind. You're not aware of anything else. You're not aware of your coarse body. You're not aware of coarse mind. It's not there. So your basis of designation for I have achieved shamatha, I'm resting in shamatha. Your basis of designation when you're leaving this body and heading off into the bardo, what is the continuum that carries on? Not your coarse one that's dependent on the brain, the body in general. What carries on from lifetime to lifetime is that stratum, subtle energy mind. In which case you could from the bardo look back and say, oh, I was a human being a little while ago. But now I'm in the bardo. And what's your basis of designation? That is equally valid for saying, I was a human being. I'm no longer. If you don't have a human body, you're not a human being. But I used to be a human being. I see, oh, I'm watching my funeral. There they are grieving for me and divvying up my estate. So that's valid. Yes, you were that person. They're all hovering over the grave looking at dead meat. And you're watching them, watching their living meat. And they're grieving for me, and I'm here. So what's the common basis of designation? Well, it's not the meat, not the coarse mind, subtle energy mind. And you can anticipate, in some time I'm going to be someplace else. The bardo will finish, and I'll be embodied someplace else. So there's the subtle basis of designation of bardo being, right? And then the very subtle mind is Rigpa. It's the indwelling mind of clear light, primordial consciousness. And that is, just like in the coarse and subtle level, on the very subtle level, the primordial consciousness is inextricably of the same nature as Ye She Ki Lung, the energy of primordial consciousness. And that is where you are right now. Wherever you are, your substrate consciousness is there, the subtle energies are there, not someplace else, and not to be achieved in the future. And right where you are right now, there's also, hidden in plain sight, subtle energy, very subtle energy, which is the energy of primordial consciousness and primordial consciousness. So they're all there. So at any time, you may designate yourself on the basis of any of those three tiers. Designate yourself as a woman, a man, American, Swiss. Designate yourself on a deeper level as one who's achieved shamatha or will achieve shamatha, will be reborn some other place in the next life. Or on the deepest level, designate yourself on the basis of your own Buddha nature with its concomitant energy. And then if you like, you can rise as Vajrasattva. And that's as valid as anything else. Equally valid. Vajrasattva, Tara, it's your choice. You know, on that basis of designation. So, in such a case, he said, the practical instructions affirm how do you determine the nature of existence of the mind? How exist? Its empty nature. Its ultimate nature. How do you determine the nature of existence of the mind? Here he's clearly referring to its ultimate nature. How do you do that? One identifies the mind in order to determine the nature of existence. You identify the mind. You identify appearances of the mind. You identify how you designate the mind on the appearances. And having seen how you've designated the mind, this is my mind. My mind is agitated. My mind is calm. then you can say, oh, okay, what's the nature of the mind so designated? So you identify it, and having identified, do you have a mind? Yes. Have you seen it? Yes. Okay, how does it exist? If you haven't identified the mind, you're in no position to ask how it exists. And that's true for everything else. If you don't know whether Higgs bosons exist or not, you're in no position to ask whether they exist relative to a measurement system or whether they're really absolutely out there and were discovered as pre-existing entities with Large Hadron Supercollider. You're in no position to ask that question if you haven't even identified whether they exist or not, and whether you haven't identified them, if you haven't found them. You're not ready to ask the second question. But once you have, and they pretty much have now, Higgs bosons exist. We did extremely sophisticated measurements. We discovered them. Good. Now that you've identified the Higgs boson, good. How does it exist? That it exists only relative to your measurement system and the conceptual framework in which you conceived of the experiment? Or does it really exist out there independently? Metaphysical realism. Yeah. So, going very slowly through a very dense text. But there we are. We'll end there for now. But he's giving us an enormous amount to work with here. So incredibly rich. With very few words. And that's why we're going slowly. I just don't feel like... I feel it would be... You know, I used to play piano in a very mediocre way. And there's some pieces I really loved. The first movement of Moonlight Sonata. It's just, you know, it's exquisite. A lot of Chopin preludes. I love them. And when you're playing something you really love and you say, this is just exquisite music, the last thing you'd want to do is say, oh, we're short of time, but I'll play it really quickly. That was the Moonlight Sonata going around really quickly. That would be quite of a travesty. And similarly, this is more beautiful than the Moonlight Sonata. So sorry, I can't go quickly to take our time. So by the way, in case you haven't noticed, the smorgs that was on my lap, it's gone. Only the laptop, but no smorgs. It's vanished. But don't worry, it'll come back.